Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in on this Thursday afternoon. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. We'll talk to him about what's latest in real estate that he's been writing about at Crane Chicago Business. A little bit later in the show, Roger Cheng, the executive editor at CNET. A couple of stories there. There was a sort of a cut-rate phone called Blue that Amazon has been selling, one of their preferred phones. I think it's like $60 or something. And they just pulled it from the site because of problems with or concerns about security and China. So we'll talk to Roger about that. Also, do you have a neighbor with a really loud Mustang? Apparently, the newer Mustangs are coming out with a quiet mode. They're inside voices or neighborhood voices. So we'll talk to Roger about that. Elise Glink will be along a little bit later as well, talking about the jobless numbers. You know, the jobless figure for July comes out. Amazon is in the middle of hiring 50,000 people this month, and they say that's big enough to have an impact on the jobless figure next month. So that's coming up with Elise. But right now we say hello to Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. What's up, friend?
Not much, Steve. How are you?
Good. So a lot to talk about. Carrie Wood's house in Lake Geneva. I want to get to that a little bit later.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
We've always had a great time over there. Carrie and I go fishing on the dock.
Yeah.
It's just very pleasurable.
You use the wave runners. The dock is one of the main features of the house.
I liked it. Well, I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Yeah, right.
Let's go to the south side first. Because
okay.
I love this story you write about this guy whose plan was to buy up these houses, really cheap houses, fix them up, and then resell them. The idea of improving the neighborhood, making a profit too, didn't quite work out the way he wanted to. But it's interesting the way it did work out.
Yeah, I was interested to see that when he couldn't resell, he was buying distressed properties, many of them two flats, in difficult Southside neighborhoods, and his goal was to sell them to community homeowners. And I was interested that when he found that he couldn't sell them, most people either in those neighborhoods either couldn't or wouldn't buy. Either they didn't have the credit scores, didn't have the income, or didn't want to buy because they may leave Chicago soon, those
right.
kinds of reasons. He found he couldn't sell them. He didn't stop doing it. He kept doing it, keeps rehabbing, and is renting them.
So he's buying like two flats for $25,000-$50,000?
Yeah, generally distressed, generally in foreclosure or foreclosed, and with, in many cases, utilities are gone, that kind of thing. That's the going rate in a lot of those neighborhoods.
Sure.
And so what he does is he rehabs them, and then he actually sells them to his investors and then manages for those investors, manages them as rentals. The goal is down the line, as these neighborhoods do come back, to sell them off.
What's he sell them to the investors for?
In the actually less than a homeowner would pay. I'm sorry, more than a homeowner would pay. In the $175,000
okay.
range. And these are two flats.
And the people don't want to buy them because, as you said, they can't. But I know you talked to some residents, too, who said, look, if I'm going to buy a house, a lot of middle-income African-Americans
yeah.
are leaving the city.
This is one of the cross currents, is that a lot of the people you would hope to buy in those neighborhoods are saying, I'm leaving the city, for all the reasons that are plaguing the South and West
right.
sides. And I spoke to a woman right next door to one of the rehabs that Alex Alsaba's firm is doing. And she said, you know, if I had that money, I would just move. I'd buy something in the suburbs. And so that's one of the reasons. But another reason that people aren't buying in many cases is not just because they may leave the suburbs, but they may leave the Chicago area. As we know, Chicago and Illinois have a big outflow problem. And so there just wasn't enough of a market to sell.
Well,
so
he's
renting them.
Is this guy a Don Quixote? Is he a real estate developer first? Or what's behind all this?
He comes from a real estate background. He was in a couple of other real estate businesses, valuing foreclosures, that kind of thing. Don Quixote, I hope it turns out that he's not, but certainly everybody's plan can go wrong at some point.
Right.
But he seems to really have some legs under him. He seems to have investors. Most of them are from out of town. Many of them are from California, where he's from. And one of the reasons they'd be interested is that you can't get rental investments in places
California.
Like San Francisco for the prices you can get in Chicago.
And I know that you wrote also that he will hire actual house sitters to live in the house.
Yeah. You know, it's a nice sort of organic program he's got, because he's renting to locals, hopes eventually to sell to locals. He's employing locals. He's employing people who live in the neighborhoods. And he also, you know, some of these neighborhoods are troubled.
Right.
And as soon as you put in new copper pipes, somebody's going to come and pull them out. So he actually puts house sitters in the buildings. In many cases, they know the neighbor, they're from the neighborhood, and they can say, you know, don't touch this one.
Are there other guys like him out there?
There are. I can't find anybody working at this scale. And okay. I asked around to lenders and things, and nobody seems to be operating at this scale. Rehab on the South and West Sides is a very fertile business right now. In many cases, people are in the places that are already emerging. Like, for example, there's a lot going on in Woodlawn. He's working in West Woodlawn. I'm sorry, I should say there's a lot going on in East Woodlawn. He's working in West Woodlawn, which isn't quite to the same level yet.
Okay, and so let's go back to the investors, the people who are buying these mm-hmm. houses. How long can they wait? I mean, is this a good bet for them, or are they the ones most at risk?
Well, I would think that the rental population would be pretty stable on the South Side. His are primarily on the South Side, but as well, the same would be true on the West. I would expect that you could hold on to them for quite a while. One of the questions
would be... They're making
money
now, right?
Yeah, they're making money via rental. One of the questions would be, how long do these investors want to hold on? And we don't know yet. He's only been doing this a few years.
All right, let's go from there to the very Tony area of, what do you call it, Streeterville, outside the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art,
right?
Which I was surprised, it's its 20th anniversary?
It opened in 1996.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when it did. And so they did a little rehab. They put a restaurant mm-hmm. on the first floor. Mm-hmm. Restaurant needs exhaust, and oh my God, it's messing with the view.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, one thing, all the people in the story did say, I know that a view isn't guaranteed. In the city,
it kind of is in this situation, though, isn't it?
But there's this sort of tacit guarantee in this case. I covered the project to build the MCA back in the early 90s.
Old man.
And I know. Well, I was in junior high at the time as an intern. But I remember very well the architect, Joseph Paul Klei, who's from Berlin, and the board members and the director of the museum saying, we're building a five-sided structure, four walls. It should be visually appealing from five sides, four walls and the roof, because they were building this low-rise building with a canyon of high-rises on two sides. And they knew affluent residents, were going to be looking at the roof. And they said, you know, we're going to make the roof attractive. It's not going to be full of mechanicals, that sort of thing. And it is. It's got these really nice glass skylights for lighting the galleries below. And that's almost all. There have been some cell phone towers and things. But... now, because of this rehab, there is mechanical equipment that's been plopped on the roof. And as it happens, because the restaurant will be on the north side of the building, the mechanical equipment is on the north side, which faces the residential neighbors. If they had been on the south, there are hospitals there and maybe less complaints.
And when they built it 20 years ago, they did agree to run changes by the neighborhood.
And they had a higher level of communication.
And they did, sure. did they not do that?
In this case, well, so... There's no rule that says they can't put on the roof what they put on the roof. There is, however, sort of an understanding that, you know, you talk to your neighbors. If I were going to put up a pink fence between my house and yours, I'd say, Steve, what do you think of a pink fence?
Right.
Right. And the MCA did not do that, just put the equipment up there. And that sort of, I think it's starting out that way that made it a little bit of a battle.
So they're going to work it out?
They are working it out. Alderman Hopkins got involved and he said, you know, let's talk about some solutions. And he had an online survey. The MCA suggested a couple of different options for screening this equipment. They can't, they say, move the equipment off the roof. So they created several different types of screen. And the residents and others voted, and the one that was most preferred is, it's sort of a pyramid shape. It looks like the skylights that are already there, and that's the one they're working on now.
Well, you know, I kind of mock the residents at the top, and I understand why they would be upset if they're, you know, used to looking out at something very nice, and all of a sudden it's not.
I looked out. I was in the living room of one where what you were looking out at was these nice glass skylights, these beautiful paneled glass
art.
Lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now what you're looking at is a big sort of, it looks like a big piece of refrigerator equipment. It's not right in her, like blocking her window, but it is what she looks at. And if you've been looking out at an attractively designed roof for over 20 years, it is a little bit of a shock.
Yep. Well, even the most attractively designed things get a little old.
Yeah, exactly.
Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. It talks about real estate. We'll get to Glencoe a little bit because, as one realtor says, Glencoe is red hot.
Red hot.
And but let's start first in Lake Geneva because, you know, I just love the story. The Cary Wood, they had a house up there, a nice big house on the lake, 120 feet of frontage, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. And
really nice house.
And, you know, I had a house, my wife and I had a house in Saugatuck 20 years ago. It wasn't the same.
Probably not.
We couldn't even see the water. But then we had a couple of kids and just kind of realized it wasn't what it used to be and it didn't make sense, which is kind of where they are with this Lake Geneva house.
That's what Sarah Wood said to me. Yeah, they were about to list the house and she said, well, when they bought it, they still lived in the city. But more importantly, their kids were little. So you can tell your kids, this is what we're doing for the weekend. Now they live in Winnetka, and Winnetka's a little bit more of a beach town than downtown Chicago is. But also, their kids are older, and their kids have schedules and things to do and stuff, so it's just harder for them to get to Lake Geneva than it used to be, and so they have to sell the big, fabulous house.
And they're asking, what, $5 million?
Almost $5 million. And you know what was interesting? I think you saw in the story, they had it listed earlier this spring at nearly $6 million without Cary Wood's name attached to it. And she told Sarah,
I love this.
She told me specifically, he didn't really want to sell. He kind of still wanted to fish. She said, I'm married to a Texas fisherman. He wanted to keep the house and fish off the dock. But eventually they realized he's not even getting up there. So they'll sell. And what she said is probably get back to Lake Geneva once the kids are grown. Like you guys will get back to Saugatuck.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. That's exactly what we told ourselves. So good luck with that. We'll see how that goes. Okay, Glencoe. Red hot, right?
More sales over $4 million than any other North Shore suburb was not true in the past. Last year, Winnetka would have, and really in almost any year, Winnetka would be the one. But Glencoe has had a bunch of really high-priced sales. Winnetka's down for the year, still doing well, but has fewer than last year. And Glencoe had one last year, four this year.
Why is it? Why is it on fire, as the real estate agent said?
Well, any one of those really high-end listings is really just sort of a moment in time. You know, it just happens that I have a mansion on the lakefront in some suburb, and I put it on the market today. Our kids just grew up or whatever it would be. But it appears that Glencoe's had some really good values. Glencoe, of course, has great schools, that kind of thing. Not much has changed. It's just that some great properties have come on the market.
And you know what Glencoe has, and this probably would have an impact, is just a wonderful downtown.
Yeah, it has a cute little downtown.
They had their art fair, I think it was last weekend. And my wife and daughter went this weekend, this year. But it's just a great place to go have dinner and just to walk around. It's a real downtown.
Winnetka has the same thing, but part of the difference, I think, is that Winnetka has seen several turnovers in recent years of these high-end properties, and Glencoe is seeing it now.
All right, Westtown, where there's a house for sale now for $7.8 million.
Yeah.
What's it going to go for?
I have no idea what it will go for. A lot of time, you know, a lot of sellers at that level can wait until they get their price. Two of the interesting things about that house, you saw the pictures, which obviously we can't show on the radio. It is outrageous. It's very cool. It was designed by the seller and his architect to be as cool as it could possibly be. But one of the questions is, nothing has sold over there at about Western and Ashland and Grand.
Okay.
And nothing has sold over there for more than about $2.5 million. There are some $4 million sales farther north in Bucktown, about like a mile north. But that's quite a price. You know, that's the biggest, most fabulous house on the block. And generally what people say is you don't want to be the biggest, most fabulous house on the block.
Why is he selling?
He's shifting his base to Palm Beach.
Well, who would?
He told me. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the rest of us, we're not going to live in $7 million homes in Westtown.
Right.
But we are going to tool around on Facebook. And we're going to see more and more homes for sale by RE/MAX on Facebook.
Yeah, you may already have because they did a test run. RE/MAX of Northern Illinois, which is not the same as RE/MAX National, just to be clear. So it's happening in Northern Illinois, is promoting its new listings on Facebook and Instagram. For the first 24 hours, any properties on the market, it'll be showing up on Facebook and, again, on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. So if you – and they're geotagged. So if you live in Deerfield, you're going to see a lot of listings in Deerfield, Northbrook, that sort of thing.
Right.
And it's a pretty interesting sort of a concept. I had somebody, a real estate agent, tweet to me, I bet they get a lot of new agents because agents want that kind of promotion of their property.
Why just for the first 24 hours?
That's when it's fresh meat.
Okay.
Right? I mean, especially in this climate we're in now with really low inventory, buyers want to see things the minute they come on the market.
I think people are going to love this because they want to know what the house next door is
exactly
going for.
Yeah, that too.
We talked about the whole Zestimate thing and everything.
Yeah, right.
So I filled out a profile on Zillow because I wanted to correct some things with my house.
Oh, did you really?
I did. And now I get emails from them about houses in my neighborhood for sale.
I'm sure, constantly.
That's how I start my day, every day, Dennis Rodkin.
Well, now as soon as you sign on Facebook, you'll be seeing REMAX listings too.
Good to see you. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust, and not too much of Lollapalooza, okay? Keep it under control this year.
Yeah, I'll be careful.
Wintrust Business
Lunch.
I'll
keep my shirt on.
Okay, 720 WGN. Thursday afternoon here in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue. Roger Chang is on a phone line. He's the executive editor for CNET. Roger, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, a number of things I want to talk to you about. Let's start with Reddit. Reddit just picked up another $200 million, valued at, I think, you guys are writing, $1.8 billion. And Reddit is one of those things where, you know, my son is into it big time. I've tried a couple of times. I don't quite get it. And I'm not sure it's a force for good.
You know what? I wouldn't call it a force for good or evil. It really is. You know, it presents itself as the front page of the internet. And it does drive a tremendous amount of traffic. Anything that goes viral on Reddit tends to go viral on the internet as a whole. So it's so while some folks aren't really comfortable using Reddit, there are enough users of that site that it is significant and influential.
All right, let's talk about the force for ill, because right, it has had trouble. I know it's cracked down a year or so ago, but that's kind of where a lot of hate groups or hate in one way or another finds a voice, where they get into these subgroups, they find others like them, and then they just sort of spew about.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also sort of a source for forms of pornography and other offensive material. As you said, Reddit has tried to crack down on some of this, but it's sort of this tough line they've got to walk, right? Reddit became popular because it became a place for you to go and find other folks with like-minded interests that are probably niche.
It was kind of a wild west thing, right? No, not too many
exactly.
Rules at the start.
Totally. And so now that it's gotten bigger, it's gotten a little bit more mainstream, so to speak. It is encountering this problem, and I don't think it has a complete solution yet on how to stamp out some of the more egregious content that flows through that site.
All right, so where it sits, sort of 300 million monthly users, as opposed to Twitter, which is 328 million, Facebook, 2 billion. So probably comparable to Twitter. A lot of people talk about Twitter in the media and elsewhere. You don't hear quite as much about Reddit, but with this new money, they're hoping to, well, I don't know, I was going to say go a little bit more mainstream. That's probably not it, but at least present themselves to a few more eyes.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of done that over the last few years. Obviously, the Ask Me Anything feature that it has in Reddit, is popular enough that, President Obama and numerous high-profile figures and celebrities have taken to that forum because they understand the influence and the passion of that audience. So there's something to that Reddit audience that is valuable to a lot of people.
So are they going to try to look more like Facebook? Is that what their redesign is about?
I don't think they're going to go as mainstream as Facebook now.
Okay. Another thing that struck me from the story, I tend to associate Reddit with a younger audience. Is that fair or not fair?
I don't necessarily know if that's really the case. I think it kind of ranges because Reddit's been around for a long time.
And okay.
It was founded in 2005. There are a number of users out there who are, I'm sure, older, like,
finish that sentence.
I'm not going to try to finish that sentence. You're going to get a pretty wide cross section.
Well, here's why I asked.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, because in the story by Terry Collins, the next to last graph says, despite Reddit creating a mobile app last year, about 80% of its users visit from a desktop. That just surprised me. I wouldn't think that they would get their action from a desktop as opposed to a mobile app.
Yeah, and I think that kind of speaks to the fact that there might be that older audience that's more comfortable viewing this content on a large screen as opposed to a phone.
I might be guilty of that. Okay, I'll take that. Let's move on to Amazon and Blue. These phones, BLU, which I didn't know much about, but it sounds like they were moving quite a few.
Yeah, it was actually one of their models was the top selling phone on Amazon. Now keep in mind, most phones in America are still sold through your traditional carrier store. Right? You go to a Verizon or an AT&T to get your phone. But folks who are a little bit savvier or a little bit more comfortable buying phones directly, who really want to save money, Blue was an excellent option. I mean, these phones were selling for $50, $60. Obviously there are compromises. The phones are a little bit slower. They use, less expensive parts and components. So, you get what you get for your money, but for many, it was a good deal.
Yeah, if you just wanted a phone, right, and with a few of the bells and whistles, why spend $600 when you can get one for $60?
Exactly.
And yet, there now is this trouble with security. It's sort of a triangular story, I guess, because you've got Blue, and they're selling to consumers, but they're selling largely through Amazon, and now it's Amazon that is taking them off their site because they're concerned about Blue's customers and security. The idea is that if Blue's customers suffer security breaches, that's going to make them angry at Amazon. How did I do it explaining that?
Yeah, and that's exactly the problem. You summed it up really well there. Basically, these Blue phones were using, some of the older ones were using software from a Chinese company called Shanghai AdUp Technology. And this company was shown actually last week at the hacker convention, Black Hat DEF CON, that they were picking information from users, stuff like location information, signifiers for like what the phone is, little details like that, and kind of shipping them off into a server in China, which they actually didn't disclose. They finally changed their privacy note to kind of terms of agreement to clarify this, but they sort of did it after the fact. And so when this controversy hit, and this actually had happened last year as well, they got hit by basically the same controversy, and Blue basically said, "Oh, it was a mistake. The company, the Chinese company they worked with, made a mistake, and they fixed it." Since the controversy hit again, Amazon basically just didn't want to deal with the controversy, right? They saw these privacy concerns, and they moved quickly to remove them from their store. And it's interesting to note that Blue was one of the big partners for Amazon's Prime exclusive phones program. This is a program that
offers
phones for
so it's sort of like
half off.
So they're kind of like endorsed by Amazon.
Pretty much, yeah. These phones are sold at a deep discount. In exchange, the lock screen has ads. You can get like Motorola phones. You can get other phones on this program. Blue was one of the key and early participants of this.
All right, so reading about this, it sort of is reminiscent to me of Walmart, and that Walmart is so big that it can kind of dictate to producers what product to make, how to package them, or how to make them. In a way, this is Amazon dictating to a company that sells on its site how to secure their product.
Yes, but you have to understand, like, this is a situation where Blue is a fairly small company that relies on Amazon for a huge bulk of its sales. So, yes, the influence there is significant.
Right.
But if this was a case of, Apple or Samsung, Amazon would have a lot less.
It would be quite as much muscle. Right. Roger Chang's on a phone line, executive editor of CNET. And, tell me a little bit about how I can make my neighbor's Mustang quieter.
That's actually one of the stories from our CNET Roadshow sister site. It's a story from Andrew Kroc. Basically, obviously, the V8 roar is loud. It's a sweet sound if you're the actual Mustang owner. If you're the neighbor, it's probably not that great. But there is a quiet exhaust mode that actually kind of lowers the decibel level to something that's similar to what a dishwasher would sound like.
I like that. And you can do it, let's say it's early in the morning, you want to be good to your neighbors, you just put the sort of inside voice mode on, a quiet mode, and you don't have to disturb them. But then when you go out for lunch, you can make the noise again.
Exactly. That's the thing. If, as you said, especially early in the morning when you don't want to wake up your neighbors, that's time to kick in the quiet exhaust mode.
Roger Cheng, the executive editor of CNET. Hey, great to talk to you again. I look forward to the next time.
Yep. Take care.
A little muggy out there. I know some spots are getting hit hard with rain now. It might hit more a little bit later. They're watching down at Lollapalooza to make sure that everything goes. It seems as if Lollapalooza just brings violent weather. Well, we hope that's not the case today. Elise Glink is on a phone line to talk about personal finance, as she does each week. Of course, you can read more about Elise Glink at bestmoneymoves.com. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here. And it is raining really, really hard on the North Shore right now.
See that? So we get weather, we get traffic, we had agribusiness, it's all here. Well, tomorrow the jobless number comes out for July. The ADP report from earlier this week, I think I said earlier, is 187,000 jobs created. I got a couple digits screwed up. I think it's 178. But more than expected. So that portends good things for the report tomorrow. And, you know, Elise, we were talking yesterday about the fact that Amazon had these big job fairs at Romeoville and in Kenosha around here. But then actually all over the country, they're going to hire maybe 50,000 people. Is that by the end of the year or just by this month?
I think they wanted to hire it by the end of the day.
Wow.
Really looking to hire all of those people just in August. And normally what we've seen over the last few years, Amazon has been growing rapidly. But what they've been trying to do at the end of the year in time for the Christmas holiday season is somewhere around October they staff up. What we're seeing now is that they've pushed that back to August to try and find another 50,000 people. I think that's a recognition of, number one, how tight the job market is, and number two, where they're actually looking, because they're building in more rural areas.
But that these aren't temporary jobs, right? The idea is that these are permanent jobs.
Correct. These are permanent jobs. They are looking to build huge warehouses, and they are already building huge warehouses that are near to airports, outside of metropolitan, on the edges of metropolitan areas, where they can buy large tracts of land and then build these massive football fields
right.
would fit inside them, I think.
Okay, so if the jobs numbers are good this month because ADP says 178,000 jobs were created, next month, if you throw in almost an artificial extra 50,000, we're probably going to see that reflected in the statistics.
There's no question that it would actually have a direct impact on the numbers that are being reported, both in terms of jobs created, jobs taken, and then also the unemployment numbers should drop even below where it is today. The hope is, of course, economists all over the country are hoping that people will say, hey, maybe I'm going to stop sitting on the sidelines and I'm going to get back into this job market. So what you might see is a temporary rise in the unemployment, but that would be a good sign because it would mean people are coming into the marketplace.
We were talking yesterday as well with, was it Bankrate, Bennett? We were talking with the group about income and increases year over year and which jobs were having a greater increase in salary. And warehouse workers, the truck drivers, were among the companies or the areas that were doing very well, sort of a reflection of the increased demand because of Amazon.
Yeah, I think that you're seeing what you're going to be seeing. It's sort of interesting. This plays into what Elon Musk has been talking about, where artificial intelligence will very soon in the next couple of years take away jobs from, say, the truck drivers. But yet
right.
we're going to see an increase in need for people with those skills running forklifts and driving maybe trucks around the Amazon facility. So it's an interesting mix of how jobs are porting from this kind of older economy of truck driving into the newer economy of Amazon delivery.
I like that. You sent me a link to a Washington Post story, and in it, one of the experts said that in many parts of the country now, yes, retail jobs have been diminishing, but the number of warehouse jobs has actually grown to a greater number than the retail jobs have diminished. So there's a net plus, and the warehouse jobs, as I read, are better paying jobs anyway.
They are, and they also aim for more diversity, or they then tend to attract more diversity. And so you're seeing more diverse workforces in these manufacturing jobs or in these warehouse jobs. And that's kind of a nice thing as well. And when you see them in places around the country where maybe unemployment has been higher, more rural areas, then what you're seeing is, I think it's a benefit all the way around.
You know, you mentioned diversity in all of that. And what we've been watching through all of this is the jobs numbers are good. The wages haven't increased like you might think in a tight jobs market. Now, yesterday, the president came out in favor of this reduction in legal immigration in the country because he said that unskilled immigrants actually create a downward pressure on wages in this country. Now, the reports I've read, I mean, I think you can find stuff on either side, but by and large, I don't know if that's a good argument. You know more about this than I do. Do immigrants force wages downward?
That is not my understanding. So I'm not sure what statistics and studies the president has been reading, or maybe his advisors have been reading. It is a very conservative view of it. But if you think about it, there are a whole lot of jobs in this country that people who were born in America don't seem to want to take, or at least not at the price that they're being offered at. And I think about immigrants, migrants who come in and they pick fruits and vegetables in the right. fields of California. There's a lot of stuff going on right now with those farmers and the large-scale production where some of the fruit is being left to rot on the vine simply because they can't find enough people to pick the fruit. And so we need to figure out how to make that work for everybody.
Yeah. Elise Glink on the phone line. Nice to talk to you again today. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. That's Elise Glink. You know, she's the publisher of thinklink.com, but the CEO of Best Money Moves. I don't know if you've checked out Best Money Moves yet. It's an HR app for businesses, helps the workers sort of measure their financial stress and then kind of deal with that stress. Find out more about that again and find out more about Elise at bestmoneymoves.com.